Welcome to the Westwood Church Podcast. I'm Molly Vetter, the senior pastor at Westwood. I'm glad you've chosen to listen in to this sermon from our sanctuary. Please know, you're always welcome to join us in person on Sunday mornings at 10. Our sanctuary is a sacred, stained glass lit space. There, prayers, pipe organ, and choir mark sacred time when we get to refocus our lives around the gift of God's radical, inclusive love. We're a church committed to justice, kindness, and walking humbly with God. So thank you for listening in today. We encourage you to share and subscribe to the podcast, and also invite you to follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Most of all, we encourage you to join us in the living out of our faith for the sake of God's love.
I was ordained a United Methodist clergy person in the year 1970. This is the 50th year of my ordination. In 1970, the United States featured 12.5 million United Methodists. This year, the United States features about 7 million United Methodists. We have lost 40% of our membership in the time of my ordination. I hope there's no connection between those two events, but sometimes I wonder. Because the church is struggling so much to keep its membership, to try to make things the way they used to be, or at least to make them more lively, the church thinks about all kinds of ways they might change what they're doing. I taught in a seminary for 33 years, and during that time, we heard from the churches regularly about what we ought to be doing to help create better preachers for churches. So, some people said we should have different kinds of music. So, we tried different kinds of music. And some people said we should have different kinds of worship. One worship experience in our chapel, somebody stood in the front, as I'm doing, and they had a ball of twine in their hands, and they tossed it into the congregation, and the congregation threw it around the whole congregation until everybody was connected together. You see the point? Well, that didn't seem to work very well either. All kinds of things that people had in mind to try to make things better than they seemed to be. Toward the end of my time at Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, they said, what we need to do is to have leaders. I mean, real leaders. No more of this namby-pamby, wimpy, whatever do you think stuff. But somebody who stands up and tells people what to do. And how to do it. I mean, that's, after all, what CEOs are like, aren't they? They'll tell people what to do, and they don't do it. They get rid of the people, right? So we should have real leaders, we were told. You know, there's a problem with that in my mind, though. What is genuine leadership? What's legitimate leadership? That question, I don't know that we asked that one or answered it very well at all. The reality was that toward the end of my time, they formed what is called a relationship of leadership, a thing that we put together with a board and with requisite leadership itself. And it spent a lot of money on that. But I don't think we still got to the question, what is real leadership anyway? And I have the feeling that the church has consistently borrowed from the culture the answer to that question. Let me show you what I mean. In the year 1513, a rather famous person whose name I'm sure you know, Niccolo Machiavelli, wrote a very famous little pamphlet called The Prince, Il Principe in Italian. Now, Machiavelli is now, it's become a term, of course, that means that people are just terrible and awful, and I don't think Machiavelli was that bad at all himself. What he did was to create in words what had already been happening in his own communities. The model for the prince was Cesare Borgia. And Cesare Borgia was nobody's fool. Cesare Borgia ran the world in the way he thought it needed to be run. And part of the way he ran the world was to occasionally fudge the truth. Well, let's be clear, he lied quite often. And he also was very tough. He also said, I know what to do, and I'll do it, and if I have to kind of twist things a little bit to make it work, then that's what I'm going to do. And what Machiavelli put in his book was exactly that. Look, The problem with leadership in our community, we're talking about Florence in the early 16th century. The problem with leadership in our community is it's too infected with this Christian stuff. This stuff about being kind one to the other. This stuff about sharing one's life and purpose one with the other. That stuff doesn't work. What we used to call good leadership meant moral leadership, he said. But that's not good leadership. Good leadership is what works. What makes it possible for us to live in the world with strength and power and to make things happen in the way they need to happen. Now, Machiavelli was not the first person to say that. Good grief. There have been persons who talked like that forever. Go back to the kings of England, Henry II, Richard Plantagenet. It's pretty obvious he was very much the same. Even though the church supposedly provided the model, if after all it was Jesus hanging on a cross, forgiving those who had put him there, right? But somehow it never worked. It never really happened in life. Leadership became and has become since that book, The Prince, whatever works. Now, we all know here that the current occupant of the White House buys into this full bore. When he gets in trouble with people, he fights back. He bullies them. He tells them how terrible they are. But Donald Trump is not the only person ever to do this. I mean, after all, you could go back in the history of our own leadership in this country and find persons, yes, even Democrats, who respond in exactly the same way. If you hit me, I'm going to hit you. You throw a missile at me, you're going to get few missiles at you. That's the way the world works. That's what Machiavelli has said, and that's the way we have to do it. We said, we say, we do. Well, surprisingly enough, in the Hebrew Bible, there is a remarkable little story which she read to you so nicely earlier from Exodus chapter 32. That story is at least 2,800 years old, well before the time of Machiavelli. It's a story about Moses and Aaron. It's a remarkable story, a remarkably funny story. It's a story that asks the question that we need to ask every day of our lives. What is genuine, legitimate leadership? Here's how the story goes. Israel escaped from Egypt. Well, one tradition has them escaping, the other one has them getting out with a high hand, but that's the way the Bible is. It often tells you two things about how things happened. And then they went to the wilderness and they got lost there because Moses, after all, was a male and never asked anybody for directions. And so for 40 years, they wandered in a space about the size of Los Angeles. I mean, it's pretty strange to say the least. And so after a while, they found themselves at the sacred mountain, the mountain called Sinai that we know, although the name is not mentioned in this particular story. And Moses got a call from God, who apparently for a while dwelled atop of this mountain. And he turned to Aaron, who in some traditions is his brother, and said to him, look, I've got to go talk to God. I'm leaving you here to lead the people. Fine, says Aaron, I can do that. Moses heads off around the first turn around the mountain. And lo and behold, it didn't take them long to get very uncomfortable. The people mob together against Aaron. And they say to him, get up, make gods for us. As for this guy Moses, that guy who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what it is with him. And Aaron, remember, who has been deputized by Moses, who in some traditions of the Bible is the high priest of Israel, Aaron could respond to that request in lots of ways. He might say something like, well, no, we shouldn't do this. I mean, after all, you're the people of God. He doesn't say that. What he says is, take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring it here. When my son was in a rock band at the age of 15, he had 7 earrings in both of his ears. This is the only Bible verse he had memorized. They do. They take off the rings of gold in their ears, all of them, men, women, everybody. And they drop it in front of Aaron, and Aaron takes it, and it says In the text, the word cheret is used. It means an engraving tool. He took this golden pile and he put it in a little mold of some kind, and he got it, he heated it up and then melted it down and shaped it, formed it. The Hebrew verb is yatzer. It means to, it's an artisan verb. It means to make something beautiful and remarkable, and it takes time. And so he does. And out pops this molten calf. And the people all say, oh, good. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up the land of Egypt. Wait a minute, I thought it was Moses who did. I thought it was God who did. And Aaron realizes he's unleashed a dragon, a monster of some kind, and he says, oh, a feast to Yahweh tomorrow. Let's have a feast to God tomorrow. So he builds a little altar in front of the golden calf. And in the morning, the people, early in the morning, they start worshiping in the Israelite way. They sing, oh, for 1,000 Hebrew tongues to sing. And they worship up a storm, and they give burnt offerings and whole offerings. And then the worship is over. Aaron retires to the manse for meditation and prayer. And the people sit down to eat and drink. And they rose up too. Now, the verb is interesting there. In the old Revised Standard Version, it says, they rose up to play. Handball, I suppose. Or volleyball on the beach. The New Revised Standard Version translates revel. That's closer. Actually, the verb is the verb yitzach, and it means it's the same verb that's used to describe the name Isaac. Isaac, you remember the son who was born and whose name means laughter. But it's a certain kind of laughter. Because when Isaac and Rebekah find themselves in a foreign country, they are one day outside, the king Abimelech of Gerar that he really wasn't his wife. This is my sister. Take her. It's okay. It really was his wife. So Abimelech looks out the window and he sees Isaac and Rebekah, verb, tzahaking. I don't really know what that means exactly. I'll leave it up to your filthy minds to fill it up. But it means something that husband and wife do together, right? So the people rose up to tzahak, it says. Meanwhile, up on top of the mountain, Moses and God are having their chat. And suddenly God breaks in a very angry voice and says, Moses, go down, Moses. Your people that you brought out of the land of Egypt, they've corrupted themselves. They've fallen quickly aside of the way I assigned them. They've made a golden calf and they've worshipped it and bowed down to it and all that. And I'm tired of fiddling with them. They're just stiff-necked. So get out of my way. I'm going to wipe them all out and start over again with you. Well, I don't know about you, but I suppose if God said something like that to me, I might say something like, whatever you say, boss. I guess you know what you're doing. But Moses doesn't, you notice. What does he say? Oh, God, don't be so upset. Look, these are your people that you brought out of the land of Egypt. Ah. Moses hurls those pronouns right back into God's teeth. And then, what will the Egyptians think of you? They'll think you're a terrible fool to bring them out in the wilderness to kill them here. It's like a Halloween trick or something. Come on. Have you forgotten your covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Oh, don't forget, God. These are your people. And God changed God's mind, didn't do it. Now, the rabbis love that story because it puts human beings on a very high plane. Moses convinced God not to do the thing that God wanted to do. Moses takes the two tablets that they've just made of the Ten Commandments. He marches down the mountain with them, one in each hand. And he comes and he sees the calf and the dancing and he is furious. And now he gets mad. He hurls those tablets down, smashes the base of the mountain. He takes the calf. He grinds it up to powder. He pours it into the water and forces them all to drink it. Now the rabbis enjoy that. They have a good time thinking about what that might mean. Urinating the gods, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what they say. We're talking about a 15th century rabbi here. I didn't make that up. They'd say that. And then Moses turns to Aaron. Because that's the question, isn't it? What's Aaron doing? Why did he do this in the first place? And here's what Moses says. This is exactly the phrase I quote. What did this people do to you that you brought on them a great sin? Notice how he puts that. He gives Aaron the chance to give a response. You know, what did this people do to you that you... you did something terrible, all right, but I want to give you a chance to explain. I mean, what happened? What happened? Here's Aaron's reply. Oh, Moses. Who better than you knows the people? I mean, who better than you? They live in evil. That's what it says literally. They live in evil. They're like that. And so I said to them, got any gold? And they brought a whole bunch of gold to me. And I picked it all up and I tossed it in this fire and out popped this calf. That's exactly what he says. It's one of the great lines in all of the Bible. What are you talking about? He made that thing with a graving tool. It took a long time to do that. Oh, well, I just threw it in there and popped it out. What can I say, you know? Aaron is exactly like Machiavelli. He wants things his own way in his own time. He wants to lie and cheat in any way that he can. I want to be a leader. I can be a leader. Just watch me. I'll make it work. And Moses doesn't say anything at all. He heads up the mountain again. I'm going up to the mountain to talk to God. You have sinned an enormous sin, no doubt about it. I will see if I can, and the verb he uses is cover over, kafer in Hebrew, to cover over your sin. Sometimes that's translated something like atone. I will cover over your sin if I can. So Moses finds himself again in the face of God. And he says, oh God, the people have sinned a great sin, I know that. But if you will just forgive their sin. And then there's a dot, 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 an ellipsis in the sentence. There's no end to that sentence. There's no, as the grammarians say, no apodosis in the sentence. There's no end to it. What will happen? No. If you will forgive their sin, dot, dot, dot. But if not, if you won't, says Moses, blot me out of the book you have written. Now, that can mean two things, I think. It might mean one or the other, or it might mean both. One is, Moses does not want to live in a world where God does not forgive sin. Well, I don't blame him, do you? I mean, if God didn't forgive sin, we'd all be toast, quick, right? So I don't want to live in that world. I want to live in a world where God forgives, that's for sure. But secondly, it also might mean, maybe it means both, it might mean Moses offers his own life for those terrible golden calf people. Well, of course, we Christians know this story, don't we? We know this story. We have come today to celebrate the life and the death of one who gave his life directly for people, even though they nailed him on a cross. What could be a more astonishing scene in the Bible anywhere than Jesus hanging on that cross in the Gospel of Luke and saying, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They knew perfectly well what they were doing. They killed him because they couldn't stand what he was saying. He ate with the wrong people, did the wrong stuff. He provided a kind of leadership model they didn't like. They'd rather have Machiavelli any day. It's so much cleaner, powerful, stronger, better. And then you get John reflecting on the whole thing. There's nothing quite like, he says, somebody who gives his or her life on behalf of friends, but I think John also would include enemies. There are two ways to be leaders in this world. One is strength and power. I'm wiser than you. I'm better than you. I'm stronger than you. And there is the way of giving one's life, offering up one's life for friends and enemies. Aaron or Moses? Machiavelli or Jesus? It's always the question, isn't it?